Netscape, that product of the 1990s, the iPhone dropped 10 years ago. How did we as users and tech as an industry get here? This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton hosts an author and podcast host to talk all things tech. And that starts now.
Hello and welcome back. Thanks for listening to When It Comes to Silicon Valley and the Modern Way We Use New Technology. Well, it's more than a little helpful to ask, how did we get here? We've had the internet itself for about 50 years, the World Wide Web for 30-some years, but the average age of a worker at Facebook is 32, and that's the highest it's been since the company was formed. It's difficult to have the context necessary to navigate these new technologies at that age, and that's not a knock, by the way. It's just not enough time to anticipate where the blind spots might be before a new technology is pushed out. Facebook moved fast and broke things, and the company is reaping scorn for that reckless approach.
They don't understand that they also created a platform that has all of these externalities, that have all of these issues that are features when looked at in a certain light, but are serious bugs when looked at in another light.
This week on Techonomics, we host a three-time digital entrepreneur, podcast host, and author of the new book, How the Internet Happened from Netscape to the iPhone. Here we go.
Brian McCullough, I'm the author of How the Internet Happened from Netscape to the iPhone. And as a podcaster, I am the host of the Tech Meme Ride Home.
I am a listener, full disclosure, of Tech Meme Ride Home podcast, because I get to listen to you. You're on the East Coast, right?
Yes, in Brooklyn.
Okay. So when I get it, I'm doing the dishes around 4 o'clock California time, and then I get to work the next day at 5 a.m., and then I start broadcasting. So if I missed anything that I want to circle back on, it's like you're cribbing for me for the day before I go back on the air.
I have heard that from not a few tech journalists.
I want to ask you about your book, How the Internet Happened. What was the impetus for this? Is this just the culmination of all of your technology experience and technology coverage?
I'm a three-time founder of tech companies, so it just sort of bothered me that, you know, there have been academic books about the history of the internet going back to the 60s and where it came from, but there have been individual books about companies and people, but there wasn't one comprehensive book that explained how the internet happened to us when the internet went mainstream and started infiltrating all of our lives. And can you think of anything that has been more transformative to society? So it just bothered me that there wasn't one book that explained, okay, here's how it went down. Here's who did it to you. Here's why it happened this way. So I was thinking of people like my dad explaining how he got a supercomputer in his pocket. But also, you know, if you're 25, 26, entering tech now, I think this book is a really useful guide for explaining the last 25 years of your industry and how it got to be the way it is today.
When were you launching companies? Like, what time frame, and what were some of your competitors around whatever you were doing?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I founded my first company in college in 1999, right at the tail end of the dot-com era. It's actually the only company I still own. It's called ResumeWriters.com. But, yeah, I had venture-backed competitors. Resume.com almost had an IPO and survived the dot-com bubble bursting. Mm-hmm. Then I did two other job-based startups in the early to mid-2000s that were, social sort of plays on job search. One of them was launched the same month, I always say, as LinkedIn was. It just didn't end up becoming LinkedIn. It's always been, web-based companies, online companies, but always in the job space.
Right, in the job space. So what do you see right there right now? At the end of 2018, what's your analysis of the job space websites?
Well, that's the problem, is that we're sort of, again, I've been in this so long that I remembered when it was Monster, and that was the only game in town, right?
Right.
And then there was this period where there was Hot Jobs and Indeed, you know, is still around, Simply Hired, that sort of thing. But basically, we're back in this era where if you want to find a job, you're either going to the individual company's, you know, job pages, which is sort of, you know, a universe of different places. But LinkedIn is back to being the 800-pound gorilla in the entire industry.
The tech lash has been picking up a little bit recently. Of course, we have when we record this, it's the week of the New York Times article about Facebook's dealing with crises. Should we be breaking up big tech? Should we follow Scott Galloway's call in the Four to start breaking up big tech?
It's funny. I've been asked this several times, and I still haven't formulated an answer in my head. I think that there's no reason to jump directly to breaking up. There is a lot of things that can be done. And the word is not to curb the power of the big tech companies. It's to channel some of the things that they're doing that are creating inefficiencies in the marketplace. When you have an oligopoly at the top of any industry, it doesn't allow for innovation. And so I don't think we need to jump directly to breaking up, but we can get more proactive on doing things that will change the behavior of the big tech companies, that will create some sort of a framework that will outline what is and is not going to be permissible. You know, there's several people that have said, this is just as an example, one of the biggest mistakes of the last 10 years, I think, was allowing Facebook to buy Instagram.
Yeah.
Can you imagine right now today, if Instagram was an independent company that hadn't been acquired, it would be a real serious Pepsi to Facebook's Coke. That right there being an example of, if we can just do things like not allow whatever the next Instagram is to be swallowed up Borg-like by either Facebook or Google or Amazon or whoever it might be.
I'm definitely with you on this, and I'm glad to hear you. I'm glad to get some confirmation bias, frankly, because my take has always been that they are smothering the markets. We need to oxygenate these markets. We don't even know what we're missing out on when they gobble up all these companies so quickly. And if you go back to antitrust case with Microsoft, we wouldn't have Google.
Not to bring the book back up, but I say that in How the Internet Happened, that one of the reasons that you have the flowering that occurred in the Web 2.0 era after the bubble bursts, when things like Facebook bubble up, when Google comes, you know, there's this whole generation of these big tech companies now that were able to flower because Microsoft essentially had to sit on its hands for a decade and a half. It was gun shy. Right. Microsoft of a different era would have snapped up Amazon within 18 months of its founding, or at least as soon as it saw that it was getting success. So that's, again, the problem. And it is outlined in the book. And that's why looking back at even recent history, I think, is so valuable, especially for the tech industry. You want a situation like we had in the aughts, where you could have 1,000 flowers blooming because there were no rapacious, huge companies at the top that would just immediately gobble up all of the most promising innovators.
So how did we get here to this monopsonistic attitude when it comes to tech? I mean, honestly, the tech lash is definitely coming. And is it because you mentioned Instagram, probably the best $1 billion ever spent in business?
Sure.
Was it because regulators just didn't know what the hell they were dealing with?
Well, that's always been the problem, is that, and another reason for doing things like the book and the tech meme show is for too long, everyone has sort of treated especially internet tech, but tech as an industry in general, as sort of like this combination between it's magic and it's also like precious, and we should be hands off. We've had the internet for almost 50 years now. We've had the web for almost 30 years now. We don't have to treat these things like they're these magical unicorns. We can treat them as actual companies. We can understand how they behave in markets in rational ways. And, you know, all that happened was it was too much hands off, where when companies like Facebook achieved scale that no company in the history of the world had ever been able to attain. Facebook's addressable market is every human being on the planet. Mm-hmm. And they were allowed to address that market without anybody even noticing. And boom, once they had the market locked down, then you, as companies are wont to do, they pulled up the drawbridge behind them. We don't have to continue to let that happen. We understand the stakes of the game now.
Well, the only moat, I think, for Facebook, and let's stay here for a second, I want to get your take on this. The moat for Facebook is its users, period. Without that, that's everything. And if they wanted to move fast and break stuff, they sure as hell did, and it sure came through, and it's coming through recently. What is your take on this? You're right, 2.2 billion active users every month, and they've built, in my mind, a propaganda machine, a machine they don't really understand and know how to control right now.
Well, fundamentally, Facebook's problem is I don't think they understand what their product actually is.
Agreed.
I believe them when they say that they believe that they're connecting the world, and connecting the world is de facto a good thing. They don't understand that they also created a platform that has all of these externalities, that have all of these issues that are features when looked at in a certain light, but are serious bugs when looked at in another light. And the problem is because they don't understand that fundamental nature of their platform, and because they seemingly can only look at their mission as being connecting the world has to be good, right? What they need to do is they need to start understanding that you have to tweak a product in order for it to continue to be good. So just connecting the world is a good thing. Yes, until it's not. And Facebook needs to start understanding that, because they can take steps that will at least try to keep it connecting the world a good thing as much as possible.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, because they're choosing profitability over possibility right now. I bet you if they shut down for 5 days, put their smartest people in a room, they could figure this out pretty quickly. But I wonder how that would affect their interaction and their usership.
I think the other problem is that they've been on autopilot. They only have had one metric for success all this time: more people, more usage, more shares, more likes, whatever. You're right. They have some of the smartest people in tech right now, some of the greatest talent in the world. They just have to change the way that they're looking at their mission and how their metrics of success are. Maybe it's not more usage. Maybe it's not more shares. Maybe it's not more minutes spent on Facebook. Maybe it's more delightful things that Facebook gives me. Mm-hmm. They just need to change their focus and understand what their product has evolved into.
And that's what really stuck out to me in the New York Times article that came out in the week we record right here. And my point has always been that culture does not lead to success. Success indemnifies and ingrains culture so that when the 10,000th employee comes on, you don't have to explain what this company is about. So I think when they got the success early on, it solidified Mark's approach, which was Pollyanna-ish, that connecting everybody was a positive for everybody. And that, I think you're right. I think there needs to be an awakening or a reckoning.
Well, and the positive reinforcement that he got was that if we do this feature and people continue and people use it and they use it more and they use it more, they use it more, then that just he believed that even if people claim they don't want the newsfeed, even if the people claim they don't want this feature or that feature, well, they can't stop using it. So we actually know better than our users. You know, people accuse Apple of that sometimes, that Apple will tell you what product you want. But I think Facebook believes that just because they believe their own usage logs. But you can't see in usage logs that people are going onto Facebook obsessively and getting depressed. And they need to understand that it's not all about quality or it's not all about quantity. It can also be about the quality of your product and user experience.
And the other side of that coin, I think, would be the positive reinforcement that Facebook got with the parking fines when it comes to getting slapped on the wrist. They never have to pay for anything. It's always, we're sorry, we need to do better, and here's $50 million. Well, they make $6.5 million every hour.
Agreed. And also, it explains a lot of the weird behavior that we've seen over the last 3 years. I think what you said is right, is they learned that if we screw up, all we got to do is apologize and people will forget. And oh, by the way, they'll probably continue to use that thing that we got in trouble for. They only know one trick. They're a one-trick pony, and that trick, it's not working. That game plan, they've done it one too many times. They've gone to the well one too many times where the playbook is, oh, we're sorry, we're sorry, we're sorry, we won't do it again. And then, oh, we're sorry, too much.
We'll do better soon, I promise. Okay,
right.
Let's change gears, because I could just rant on this. But anyway, we're speaking with Brian McCullough. He's the host of Tech Meme Ride Home, a podcast you need to have. He's also the author of How the Internet Happened. Brian, you have the recent history of the internet. Where is an area of the tech sector right now that most interests you?
Well, as you know from the podcast, I too am obsessed with seeing the video streaming wars plays out. I'm obsessed with, are we really going to see true self-driving technology on our roads in a meaningful way by 2020? I'm interested in the rollout of 5G, how soon we're going to get it, because 5G could quietly be the most transformative technology of even the last 50 years, because it will allow all sorts of things, among them the Internet of Things that everyone talks about and self-driving technology. Essentially, 5G gives us the promise not just of internet everywhere, but of sensors everywhere, of an entire smart planet. So I'm super interested to see how that rolls out. And it's going to be rolling out over the next 5 years. So it's really imminent.
Yeah. And again, the week we are recording, the auction happened at the FCC for that bandwidth that everybody thought was useless. And now it's going to be the most transformative thing since the internet itself, I think. By the way, the 2-inch headline I like from the 5G, for those who are listening who don't know, is that everything that you know goes 10 to 100 times faster. I think that's a nut graph of what needs to be said about that.
Imagine that your phone and on the road in your car, you'll have faster internet speeds than your cable modem delivers to you.
Yeah, and imagine when you're in a plane and you pay for that crappy Wi-Fi. That ends. That's over with, finally.
It actually works, yeah.
Don't you have a rolling bet about the self-driving car thing by 2020 with somebody?
Yeah, and essentially what it is I believe that there will be driverless cars out on the road. They're going to be apparently in Phoenix by the end of the year. What I'm saying is you can be in the tiniest town in Iowa somewhere, and you can get an Uber right now today. I will believe that self-driving technology has arrived when they are as ubiquitous as Uber. I'm not saying they're every car on the road, but if I wanted to right now get a cab home, I could order a self-driving car. The day that that happens, then I'll believe that it's arrived. The reason I'm skeptical is because I don't think the technology is there yet. But also, can you imagine the regulatory, legal, bureaucratic headaches that haven't been solved yet? I don't believe that they will be solved in 2 years. I think it'll take the better part of a decade to solve all of those things.
I have to say it, but I'm kind of with you on this one, too, as hopeful as I am. I mean, if I'm visiting my friends in Detroit,
I'm happy to be wrong.
Yeah, that'd be cool, too. I'm also wondering about fleet cars, you know, like if self-driving fleets for Uber and Lyft and others. And I see Ford moving into the space, of course.
Yeah, agreed. It's super interesting. And again, I'm not a pessimist because I hate the technology. I actually love the technology. I just, you know, Silicon Valley is a hype machine, and sometimes the hype gets ahead of itself.
Brian McCullough, I've been looking forward to this interview all week. Thank you so much. Thank you for the work you're doing. Tech Meme Ride Home is a podcast you need to have, and How the Internet Happened is a book you need to get. Brian McCullough, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you.
That was Brian McCullough, author of the new book, How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone. Brian's also the host of the podcast Tech Meme Ride Home, which is in the ears of just about every tech fan and journalist every day at 5 o'clock Eastern. Both sources of Brian's knowledge and humor are worth a click and a listen. The links are in the show notes for this week online at kgoradio.com/techonomics.